Okay, this is the 10th session, session 10, and it's side one, and it's July 25th, 2006. So, Scott, can you, we're back onto the right side of the book, so we're doing the McLuhan quadrant again, or the McLuhan part of the book, the McLuhan thread, and I just want to say this before we go into it, or maybe it's appropriate to do it in the 10th session. The new word always prepares people for their experience ahead of time. What's going to come down in new forms of communication, technological experience, new art, it anticipates and mimes the sensory modalities, sensory content and style that people are going to have, according to McLuhan. So I want to say that this book, Thad A Communion with Bob Dobbs, put out, published in January 92, written, put together in the fall of 91, it is a new art form, mime the experience that was going to be part of the population by 95, 96, once Netscape had created the browser, 94, 95, and then millions of people got on the internet because Netscape really made it easy. And then people started experiencing chat groups, chat lines, lists, discussions around some favorite topic, and a phrase that came out of that was thread, you know, one topic, everybody be commenting on it, and that would be called a thread. Well, the form of my book presents these quotes, and these quotes are like the internet experience of people emailing back and forth with brief statements to each other. You know, they don't have that much time to go into it. Some people do. In general, it's quick, brief statement. So all this is miming the email experience, and it's divided into five writers and thinkers. Each one of those people is like a thread, and even the interaction between the different writers and thinkers is like a thread, where a thread can have different people saying different points of view. So the collage of points of view that people experience in rapidity on the internet, a lot faster than they'd ever had before. There's the old joke that groups, lines, chat lines, lists, or list groups, as they're called, they end up with people just spamming each other or flaming each other because the pattern recognition is so speeded up. And so I'm offering pattern recognition, but a hyper-pattern recognition, and that presents people, that mimes what the effect people are going to have once they all get on the internet, in North America at least. The rapidity of pattern recognition and all the chaos, confusion, and delights that came out of that. So the format of my book is made found predictive art. So for the record, poetry, theater. The thing is, one of the main cliches of looking at the internet is people started to read again. They had to read stuff, even though it wasn't as literate as the traditional book. But back to the eye. And this book is definitely, my book, Thad A Communion with Bob Dobbs, is an eye experience in the pattern of life that people were going to have in the 90s. So, with that said, can you read the first quote from McLuhan?
Sure. Want to ask you a question about what you just said, because it is a different form of visual space, because the book being a comprehensive point of view, email, in the way that the book is laid out, is kind of like fragmented little points of view.
Yeah.
So that's a different kind of visual space.
Yes, the content, you're still on the email, it's not even visual space because you're having simultaneous interaction. It's not one way. You're electrified. You're digitized. It's affecting your brain. A book affects your brain differently. And then there's the collective effects of the digital environment, what it does to the economies, outsources economies, intelligence agencies, outsources everything, makes everybody a Rumpelstiltskin. All those effects are way beyond what the book is. It's not just what the book or the digital world does on you and your senses. It's what it does to the community and other media. So the book is minuscule compared to the effect of the digital life. So, yeah, my book retrieves the eye, but the style of the content, like Finning's Wake, is in the style of the present, but it's bringing back the eye. So on another level, my book's an anti-environment to the present, which is not a visual present. It's a proprioceptive tactile present under chip body conditions. So what's the point of having an eye? Well, you bring back the eye, but it has to have the appeal of the life that people are living, and that's what my book is. I mean, if you look, open it, it begins with a quote with no index, no table of contents, just a quote. You're right in there immediately, like the internet. Turn it on, you're inside it.
Mm-hmm.
So the style of the book, it is a visual experience, but the content is in the style of the present, which is not visual. But in the end, it's a book. But it is a after image. It has no effect on people's perceptual life, because people's perceptual life is mined by the chip body and the digital proprioceptive tactile environment. And that is what is affecting all kinds of things all over the world in the 90s, as everybody knows, even led to September 11th. So a book is a puny little nostalgic artifact. So
it brings back the eye as a kind of virtual subset of the perceptual process.
Well, we don't want virtual to mean not real. Virtual is real. So it doesn't really, it props up the chemical body. And in a sense, this book, if you mean by virtual not real, this book is virtual. Whereas your digital life is not virtual, it's real. The book is virtual because it can't have any hold on anything. There's no ground for literacy. It's not there anymore. It's not an invisible ground. It's just a figure. It's like McLuhan used to say, the more people, once the printed book came in, more and more people were doing handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before that, just the monks did the handwriting. But it becomes obsolete when you bring the printed book in, so more and more people do it.
So in Bob terms, it's a holeopathic retrieval floating within the larger context or ground of the digital environment.
Yeah, it's a meme.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reminder of an experience that we used to have.
Yeah.
But it is pointing. It's not trying to retrieve the eye, though that's one side subset effect, a reminding of the visual meme. But it is trying to point out the present environment and contain it, which is the role of visual space. It contains things. So it's an after image.
Right.
It's a form of nostalgia.
Yeah, and when you say it retrieves the eye, that you mean that in both the sense the I, E-Y-E, and the I pronoun I.
Yeah, both. In the, but, you know, this book is not a normal book. It doesn't appeal to people, probably, in general.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe it would if people knew about it. Don't know what its appeal would be.
Yeah.
But people who read it and get into it, they like it.
Yeah. They just have to understand the context in which it was written.
I don't know. I think they can just enjoy the quotes.
Yeah, well, we're moving into the top of page 13, Marsha McLuhan. The quotes are slippery. That's why we're going into it, because you're going to flesh it out.
Yeah.
I read some of them, and I discovered that my mind just started. Now, when we read LaRouche, I developed a coherent notion of what LaRouche was saying.
Yeah.
When I read what we're about to read with McLuhan, my mind started splitting in all directions. It was like being on a slippery wet...
Tactile.
Yeah, and I'm like, okay, which way is my mind going to go with this in terms of what is it exactly he's trying to express? And I could go a number of different ways trying to figure out what he wants to say here. It's less defined. It's more open to interpretation. It's a little more fuzzy logic.
It's suggestive. Not, what'd you say?
Fuzzy logic.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not true, but suggestive is a good word.
Yeah, it's not precise like LaRouche is trying to do.
Yeah.
It's in the
Which
jargon.
Is the nature of the tactile medium.
Yeah, in the jargon of the 70s, LaRouche is left hemisphere and McLuhan is right hemisphere, but they're not just that simple. But definitely there's a big difference in the effect of LaRouche's conceptualizing from McLuhan's perceptualizing.
Mm-hmm.
But LaRouche conceptualizes percept. He's trying to talk about the cyborg percept.
Yeah.
And LaRouche and McLuhan is percept without conceptualizing it.
Yeah. McLuhan is perceptual, and, you know, animals are perceptual. They don't necessarily have reason.
Well, no, you know, conceptual reason, you know, every sensory modality is a form of reason or rationality. So you're expressing illiterate bias if you think reason is just I, E-Y-E. Each sense, McLuhan pointed out, had its own rationality. Problem is, visually rationalized people think that is the only sense that's rational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think it would make more sense if we're going to refer to the visual space in McLuhan terms is to refer to it as literate visual space.
Yeah.
Because visual space encompasses more than just the book.
Now, you know, I mean, most people, they call American society the last 30 years a very visual society. And they meant by that photographic and imagery.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it was seeing something as it was, not one step removed like a printed word is.
Yeah.
That doesn't look like what it's describing. So you can see the schizophrenia that comes in with literacy. So yeah, McLuhan, he probably, when he described and used visual space, he knew that it was counterintuitive to what people thought he meant by visual space. So people say, yeah, we're increasingly more a visual society. He says, no, we're not a visual society anymore. And the average American says, what do you mean? There's nothing but visuality, you know? But that's because they had an eye bias and just saw that. They didn't see the acoustic and tactile proprioceptive simultaneity going on, or the resonance. They couldn't perceive that. So their last gasp was the iconic weightlifter or nudity. McLuhan said nudity was not visual, it was sculptural. Many people think sculpture is visual, but sculpture is the bounding line. So when the eye is moving away from its actual role of separation and moves towards the other modalities, it becomes sculptural and what he called the bounding line, and moves toward the resonant interval.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be the resonant interval because the resonant interval is not visualizable. But you can see that the American is totally expressing its visual bias by saying it. We're in a more visual society than we were before. And it's interesting, what did they think was before? They read books. Why wasn't that visual? They probably thought that was oral and speech and the subvocal inside the skull.
Mm-hmm.
Was,
yeah. So
visual oral, literate oral, and now we're into literate, non-literate visual. And so McLuhan means by visual space, literate visual space.
Yeah. And people need to keep that in mind when they read McLuhan, because there's a sculptural eye and a literal eye and an oral acoustic eye and a tactile eye. And
in Gutenberg Galaxy, he talks about the conflict between the verbal and the pictorial. So the pictorial is something that's a picture. Many people think that's visual. What is verbal? Well, for most literate societies, verbal is the content of the book, right? It's speech to oneself. When you read it, it's speaking to you. So the verbal is another word for the literate visual, whereas the pictorial is the non-literate visual, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's read this. And remember, part of McLuhan working on perception is that he would create these dichotomies, these dialectics that would, on the surface, confuse people, and they'd think he was playing word games or something. But he did know what he meant, and he kept to the rules. You had to figure out what he meant. Then you could follow him. But if you didn't make the effort to figure out what his definitions were or perceptions aligned to the descriptive terms, you would be just confused. But McLuhan wasn't against shaking up people's senses and, on the first impact, confusing them. Then they start paying attention.
He wanted to shake them loose of their preconceptions so that he could communicate something new.
Right. So let's point out to him, communicate something new about what they thought was familiar. In other words, communicate and point out the new situation, which these quotes on this page will begin to deal with. So this first quote is, I look in the index, is CN, that's the code, and it's Marshall McLuhan, the article's called The Future of Banking. It was an article he wrote for the Canadian National Bank in Montreal, 100th Annual Report publication in December 74. And this is when Nelson Rockefeller was becoming Vice President of the United States.
Would you restate that? Who did he write this for?
I said that too fast, eh?
No, I wasn't fully paying attention to what you said. But
it's called The Future of Banking.
Yeah.
And it's for the Bank of Montreal, or no, not the Bank of Montreal, which is a bank. It's the Canadian National Bank, whatever that is, and in brackets, that's in Montreal. And it's the 100th annual report publication. So it's the 100th anniversary report.
Now, this was being published really for the sake of his students. This didn't actually go... Nobody at the Canadian National Bank actually received, read, and considered this report, did they?
Oh, yeah, that's what it was for. He was commissioned to write a report for them, or a statement on the future of banking. And that I found it, went to their banking documents, wherever I got them, out of the libraries or something, got a hold of it and Xeroxed it.
What did they do with it? I mean, what he was saying was so outside the world view of bankers
well,
at that time.
Not necessarily for them, because they... Bankers had to live in the present. They knew what was going on. They knew in their terms that it was a global village and a global theater, and money was information and not cash. That was the computerization enforced that view on them. You know, business people or people working in discipline and industry, they know what's what the pressures are on them. They got to deal with it every day. But the professors and the humanists may not know, because they're not directly involved.
Mm-hmm.
They're propping up older arts, older scientists, older disciplines. But the nature of the global implosion was that everybody got in on the act, because there was no difference between anything. So that's why the bankers would call in someone like McLuhan. They said, well, here's a guy who seems to know, he pretends to know what's going on. We better see what he's saying.
Do you think he had an effect on actually the practical day-to-day banking world of transaction and money-making?
Okay, well, let's read the first quote to see what he says is the world of banking and see if he could have any effect on it.
Okay. The top of page 13. The information environment of the electric world has increasingly merged private and public sectors of the older industrial world, pushing the world of staples and commodities out of the marketplace and into the political sphere. For banking, the question today would seem to be, what is its new role in a world where information is superseding hardware, in which politics has become a major form of show business? And there's a question mark there.
Yeah, because the question is, what is the role of... in a world, what is the role of banking in this new world, where politics become a major form of show business?
As show business becomes world business, the banker will experience an enormous extension of his advisory role in the political and bureaucratic sphere. The development of banking will be not toward the takeover of business, but of politics.
There's your John Birch Society conspiracy. The bankers taking over politics.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a new movie on that. Aaron Russell, the Hollywood director, made Trading Places, the movie where Bette Midler played Janis Joplin, called The Rose. And it had some success in Hollywood. He has done his own project because he's outraged at the Federal Reserve and the control of politics by bankers. So he's made this new movie called America, From Freedom to Fascism. And it's, you know, a replay of John Birch, conspiracy stuff, bankers rule. I wonder what he would think of this quote.
Yeah.
I mean, McLuhan's seeing that the bankers have to take over politics. And that's what we call the Fed chairman, Paul Volcker, and then Alan Greenspan. The interest rate runs the whole world, or the Fed does. The Federal Reserve's setting the interest rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that the whole world of show business and world business is, revolves around, apparently. So here's McLuhan. He's not telling them what to do. He's telling them what they will do.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, you guys are going to take over politics.
And now, define politics and define banking and how... banking took over politics.
That's a good description, a good question, because it begins, look at the first sentence. The information environment of the electric world has increasingly merged private and public sectors. We can think of government as the public sector and business as a private sector, or government monitors both private and public. But if we accept that the public sector is the world of business and government, and he's saying the private and the public merge, if we think of private as private ownership or capitalism, whatever we think of it, the point is that government and its opposite merge. There's no difference.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
What was separated in the older industrial world, the private and public sectors, has increasingly merged, pushing the world of staples and commodities, that would be oil, simple one, right,
mm-hmm.
out of the marketplace and into the political sphere. That means it becomes a matter of power and warfare over the raw resources.
Mm-hmm.
Copper, tin. As a matter of fact, a lot of people think the Vietnam War was an attempt by corporate entities to get a hold of the raw resources in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's staples, the world of staples and commodities. They move, they were the ground. But once you're in an information environment, they're no longer ground, they're figure. And so they get sucked into the political world. And the political world is always, on one hand, rearview mirror, because it's imposing a bureaucratic control on things. But on another level, politics is always the most engaged activity into the effects of the present, because that's where power is, and power is politics. So power is, the relations of power is what a new medium changes and influences and determines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of implications here. So,
yeah, let's see if bankers take over politics, then what, and then politics moves into show business, he says.
Right, that's really good. For banking, the question today would seem to be, what is its new role in a world where information is superseding hardware? And that means information, that's the word that makes the market. That's what comes out of the White House, what the news says is happening. That's political, and it's going to control the world of staples and industrial commodities. So where information is superseding hardware, and in which politics become a major form of showbiz. So staples and commodities have moved out of the marketplace into showbiz. And then he says that show business becomes world business. That would be the effect of the satellite, where everybody implodes one little resonating node, which is the whole world, which gets controlled by what the White House says is reality. That affects all the old previously divided sectors, private and public, political and showbiz. They all merge. Show business becomes world business. The banker will experience an enormous extension of his advisory role in the political and bureaucratic sphere. Now, that's the role of the consultant. The consultant takes over, and lobbyists and all this, advising the institutions of government, national, federal, state level, local, city level. It's all people listening to other people and people making their pitch. It's an information exchange constantly going on. So the banker becomes a major advisor on how to interpret the information environment and where it's going,
yeah.
The world of pattern recognition.
But how is this a radical departure from the past? I mean, the function of government has always been to collect taxes, so it's always been about money.
Right. And yet, bankers, 100 years ago, were not supposed to be involved with the government. They represent private benefactors of people's personal private, not public information, private, secret, public, secret, private, banking lives, secret, what you make, none of your business, it's not the community's business. That's partly what this Aaron Russell movie was about, was when taxation came in 1913, it never defined why anybody should have paid taxes. They couldn't define income tax. It is not, you don't have to pay income tax, is the point of this movie. It proves, and certain courts have backed it up, that you are not obligated to pay taxes on your income.
Yeah. But that was apparently, and they're basing that on actual constitutional law, which was put into effect when the country was founded.
No, but it wasn't. Anyways, without getting into detail.
Well, it was incorporated into the Constitution. It was the intent. But it didn't, you know, now...
No, they taxed corporations. Any gains and profits were taxed, but not your wages.
Right.
And so in 1913, they brought in the 16th Amendment and started taxing people's wages. But it was overturned by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, no, you can't do that. But that never got implemented. And so there's a big acceptance of it. Now, here's Aaron Russell making a big deal of it. But maybe there was a media effect, because we're now moving into electric age in 1913. Maybe there was some kind of agreeing that visual space had to be shared by everybody, called income tax, even though you couldn't do it constitutionally. But everybody agreed to do it, because it might be the fact that money was becoming obsolete. So it came a shared environment as a figure. The real ground was information itself in the electric age.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say taxes were already there, you have to look at how people looked at their environment and why they changed their view of the environment. There's lots of evidence that, yeah, there was deals made between government and bankers and businessmen, and all through the 19th century, the robber barons and Rockefellers, they controlled Congress and all that. But that was not the public perception of what was going on. Back then, you had to keep your opinions to yourself. You register when you would vote in public. That would register the private will into the public sphere. Otherwise, everybody had a right to their own society, and that's why, as the 20th century unfolded, the threat to privacy became a big issue. The electric environment threatened privacy. McLuhan said it did, and wiped out privacy. But the American citizen thinks it still has privacy. I mean, you just heard the latest national security agency surveilling everybody. Is that wrong?
Well, I don't know. Everybody has an opinion about that.
Right. No, but perceptually, people think they have the right to privacy, and the government should not be spying on them. And where did they get this notion of privacy, and how come the government's doing it? It doesn't sound like the old notion of privacy are being accepted anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's being justified by international terrorism. We've got to find out who wants to destroy the system and find them before they do.
Yeah, and the system is based on preserving our values, which are built up on privacy. And
private
terrorists will
private
destroy
property.
What?
Private property.
Yeah, and so the terrorists will destroy privacy and private property. Yet they are eliminated through the surveillance. So we're already, people would say, and acting out what the terrorists we figure are going to do to us. It's already being done by our own government.
Mm-hmm.
That's why people think Bush should be impeached. Other people don't think so. They think they need something has to be protected. So all these issues are come out of the statement here by McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
The development of banking will be not toward the takeover of business, but of politics. But you would say that banking is always run politics in industrial societies.
Yeah, it's always been closely coupled. Money and power. That's
right.
The show.
In industrial societies. Maybe even you could say most of the Gutenberg galaxy.
If you go back and you look at Ayn Rand's book, was it Atlas Shrugged? She's already saying the industrialists are running, you know, are basically propping up and running the world.
Well, you can go back 400, 500 years when they started to have national mercantilist economies. The kings ran that, and they taxed people, and they had booms and busts and all kinds of economic ups and downs. And the banking controlled that, supposedly. That's what the kings and a banking group could bankrupt a nation and its king. Take its credit away. So we've had this.
Sure, that was the whole threat with the Knights Templar, that they they started the banking industry, and they became so powerful they became a threat to the king, who then went out and tried to find them all and slaughter them.
Yeah, now that's 700 years ago. So you can say that the banking begins when visual society starts to be rebuilt, 1100 A.D., after the Dark Ages, where there was very little visual space in banking, medieval bartering societies, and the knights were retrieving the Roman economy of coins. So it was banking in the Roman era.
Right.
So when you have a visual society...
A visual space in the Roman era because of the papyrus.
Right. So when you have a visual space, literate visual space society, you will have banking. You get rid of the medium that creates a literate visual space society. You don't have banking, which is what happened when Rome collapsed, because Egypt took away the papyrus. Center, center, margin structure, you know, centralized centers and margins. So it comes back as visual space starts to be rebuilt at the turn of the millennium, 1,000 years ago. And then Dante writes about the battle between the different banking families. So this is, banking is a part of literate, visual, and industrial societies. But what happens when the electric world comes in, where people can have information and wealth for free? Once you have radio, I can have all kinds of experience without having to pay for it. Not like you'd buy a commodity. What would you pay for a radio in 1930? You'd buy the radio, and then you'd pay an electric bill, I guess.
Yeah.
So a token amount, very little.
Yeah. But the radio is software. It doesn't put food on your table, and it doesn't keep the hot and cold out of your shelter.
Right. McLuhan said that he created the inflation and then the collapse of the economy. So it actually wiped out a lot on hardware terms.
Yeah.
Caused great hardware confusion. So I want to read, since there's more implications of this situation, when politics becomes show business and show business becomes world business, what is politics that the bankers are taking over? Right? What is it? What do these terms mean? So I've got a bunch of quotes on this page that develop different aspects of the effects of this situation. So the next quote is from Take Today, page 211. Let's just read that.
In Catch 22,
the novel,
the figure of the black market and the ground of war merge into a monster presided over by the syndicate. And then the rest is italicized. When war and market merge, all money transactions begin to drip blood.
Yeah, in the novel Catch 22, the figure of the black market and the ground of war merge into a monster presided over by the syndicate. When war and market merge, all money transactions begin to drip blood.
Yeah. So now we're adding a new dimension to the idea of the merger of banking and politics, and now we're saying that that's been hijacked by the mobsters.
Yes.
The mobsters are running banking and politics.
Right. And Catch 22 is about black market haggling during World War II, where certain, you know, I guess military men, officers and that, were hijacking the food in the stores and warehouses and setting up their own markets. And they ran it like what later became mafia operations or syndicates. And he says, when war and market merge, all money transactions begin to drip blood. And, you know, it's in World War II that American intelligence agency, the OSS, started to use mafia people like Lucky Luciano. They started to bring the mafia in to control cities.
Yeah.
Or at least accept more. They already were controlling the Teamsters and the cities at some level. So we're now talking about, well, what does it mean when the bankers take over politics? And that's in the 70s. But 30 years before, in the 40s, the mafia taking over something. So let's go into the next quote from Take Today, page 196. Let's see what this says.
Old colonialism exploited the raw materials, i.e., quote-unquote, hardware. New colonialism exploits productive capacity and skilled management and labor, i.e., quote-unquote, software. Economic nationalism of government is thus defeated by economic internationalism of corporations. What is good for General Motors may ultimately be great for everybody but the United States.
Yeah. And then we go to the next quote from Take Today, which is a book McLuhan put out in 1972, co-written with a government advisor, expert in all kinds of things, Barry Nevitt. So in light of we're saying the Catch-22 implied the mafia, and then we have this exploitation thing between old colonialism and new colonialism, So what's the next quote I have?
Only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries are protected by public incredulity.
Yeah, so what we're describing here, bankers taking over show business, is protected by public incredulity. And the puny secrets that are protected is that the mafia runs the local economies.
And
the puny secret.
Public that's, what's a puny secret?
The mafia running the show.
Yeah.
That's protected.
Protected how?
By J. Edgar Hoover not admitting there is a mafia.
Oh, yeah.
You know that one.
Yeah. You know, and the people apparently don't want to know. You know, recently I heard this woman, I think we talked about this last week a little bit, who talked about the missing $4 to $5 trillion from the Pentagon budget. She said she came up with a plan to clean up the mob at the local level, at the community level. She gave a talk to a bunch of Christian, politically active, upper middle class people about the ways in which the mob was corrupting the local community. She came up with a plan that could clean that up. But she said that it probably would cost them something in terms of their pension funds. And she says, how many people want to go on the program and nobody raised their hands? Implicitly, nope. If it was going to affect their personal wealth, nobody wanted to clean up the crime in their neighborhood.
Who gave this talk?
This woman who was brought in to audit the Pentagon situation back in the late 90s when they discovered that there was $4 to $5 trillion missing.
And so she has been speaking since then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you heard her on some show? Or
yeah, she believes the money disappeared through mobster-type activities that go directly into the drug trade, which directly
right.
affect, and then, you know, the drug trade goes in, sets up house in local communities, corrupting local communities. And she says, so, you know, of all you upstanding Christian upper-middle-class ethical people in this room, who wants to clean up the mess if it costs you something in terms of your pension funds or personal wealth? And nobody raised their hand. So what I'm saying is that these puny secrets are able to be kept. By Hoover not admitting what was going on, the public probably didn't really want to know what was going on, because nobody wants to do anything about it if it's going to affect them at the personal level, in terms of their personal property.
Yes, and I had a thought there. I may have lost it, but...
Speak into the microphone.
Oh, sorry. I had a thought there while you were saying that, but I seem to have lost it. This point about people not wanting to do something about it,
The puny secrets need protection, but the protection, you know, like Hoover coming out and saying and not admitting what was really going on, well, the public at large probably didn't really want to know if they felt that it was going to threaten their own personal wealth or property in some way. So
because
it's probably easy to keep a secret like that if nobody wants to know the truth anyway.
Yeah, I'm
saying the public is complicit in keeping these secrets.
I agree. And I think that's what I was going to say, is the if the puny secret of the fact that they couldn't do anything about this world business, which is the merger of politics, show business, and drugs in the satellite environment, if they actually had to confront that, then they'd have to deal with the bigger issues and bigger discoveries about how they don't exist. That private identity literacy has no foundation. That the American visual and kinetic bias would have no ground. That's the big facts, big discoveries.
Why wouldn't people want to confront that? I mean, what is confrontive about that? What is implicitly confrontive in getting people to understand that that's how...
It tells you that your identity base, which is built on older media, that those older media don't provide any security anymore, and the identity you have aligned with that effect melts away when you recognize what is actually going on under the new media. That creates an identity crisis.
Yeah, well, you can continue to prop up a false sense of visual space of private property if you're not admitting that it doesn't exist. Everybody wants to cling to the illusion of...
Yeah. That's what happens. But it's understandable, because the perceptual bias of a culture determines the identity, and it's their pride and joy. So identity is not some abstract thing. It's your sensory conditioning. It's the media environment that conditioned you. And media doesn't mean just newspapers. It means all the artifacts that go into your culture.
Yeah.
So dealing with that is a major discipline. That's why I call it a yoga. I don't mean that you have to be a yogi. But when we think of a yogi, he goes into a very private situation and years of discipline orchestrating his body energies, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a strenuous activity. We need that kind of yogic restraint, yogic discipline to deal with these new media environments, or we might not have the new media environments.
Yeah, the yogi that goes into the cave and
or the monastery,
learns to work through personal identity, personal ego,
and the body processes.
He has to go through a transitional period of where he's threatened with the possibility of madness. Because if he's losing identity in order to have his consciousness become identified with, the vast the vastness of space, he's losing his mind. Hopefully, if he makes the transition, he finds himself in a larger context that's much larger than the personal identity that he abandoned or dismantled.
Yeah, and what he discovers would probably sound incredulous to those that didn't go through that training. Now, I'm saying take that paradigm of the yogi and look at our collective effects of our collective environments. We need a kind of trained perceptual discipline to understand and define what is actually happening inside these new media environments. And so it's a collective yoga. It is that kind of seriousness and discipline. Doesn't mean you go to a cave, but it requires that kind of attention and training. You understand what the heck McClellan's pointing to.
Well,
because it would threaten national identities.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen, McClellan wrote this 40 years ago, we have seen more and more national identity crises in manifesting in all forms, in all individual-based, identity-based, private identity-based institutions have had a global catharsis, as well as collective. Just look at the 1970s, the murders by death squads in Central America. They went insane.
Well, what your KPFK, your Pacifica stations went insane trying to broadcast to socially conscious human beings, but the mass of people just didn't want to know about it.
Well, no,
the collective American consciousness didn't really want to know about it.
No, let's not define it that way. Let's say the new media environments could not translate that. The new media environments is what is the mass mind. And the new media environments had no private identities. They had no categories, no nouns.
Mm.
It was a 24/7 process of tactile, proprioceptive imbibing of information on all levels. That process cannot hear one point of view saying, hey, look what's going on over there in the small 100-square-mile area. That's puny compared to satellite surveillance of the whole planet. That is the public mind. It's not the American public. The American public has merged with the media. The media is public, so let's look at the media and what it's doing on people.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at the next paragraph and see more definitions of the huge discoveries that I'm trying to refer to, replaying McLuhan, that are protected by public incredulity. Let's read the next paragraph. It's from the Barry Nevitt book, which was written after Moon died. He carried on McLuhan's work. He wrote it called Keeping Ahead of Economic Panic. But look at what happens, what I'm trying to refer to in this paragraph.
Today, apart from the government itself, the biggest show business is putting, quote-unquote, secrets on display.
Think of KPFK. They were part of that, but he's talking about the biggest show business is putting secrets on display.
Mm-hmm.
He's thinking of water. Go ahead.
Whether of the CIA, FBI, KGB, MI5, or Watergate, not like Perry Mason, but like the quote-unquote real McCoy, as nature imitates art. Private history in quote unquote in camera,
which means in secret,
has become public myth by time compression, quote unquote on camera. Just as the hitherto obscene,
that's almost like obsolete scene, the hitherto obscene,
OBSCENE, is now on stage. A deja vu of all times and places where...
Now here.
By recognizing this cliche-archetype pattern, we can, quote-unquote, prophesy what has already happened. Scenarios, obsolescent at peak performance, will proliferate as art forms, while present action moves from sequent play to simultaneous interplay and instant.